Members, we're going to call the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy Committee to order. As soon as you're ready to call the roll.
Representative Cornish. Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Hertaus.
In here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe. Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Schoen. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Members, we have quite a few things on the agenda today. So we will start with House File 1432. Representative Ward, yes, have you had a chance to check the minute?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we accept the minutes from the previous meeting.
Representative Ward's motion to accept minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Representative Green.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to move that House File 1432 pass and is referred to the General Register. Representative Green, you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is also an amendment to House File 1432.
Can you go ahead and explain the amendment?
The amendment is, well, I'll hand it off to Mr. LeBeau, and he can explain it better than I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Reed LeBeau. I represent the Fond du Lac and Boyce Fort bands of Ojibwe in the state of Minnesota. This bill was brought on their behalf to address some issues that those bands and we believe others have had with regard to getting criminal background checks that are performed not within the context of the state travel gaming compacts. Those background checks are already provided for under those agreements. This is for situations where someone applies to the band for tribal housing. We want to be able to run background checks and work with the Department of Public Safety to have those background checks performed. The author's amendment just is more specific to on the line 1.2, candidacy for tribal election. There's a specific provision in the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe ordinance that says that you can't be a felon and run for office within the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. And federal law requires that we be as specific as possible when we lay out the particular factors that we're going to run background checks or that we're requesting the state to run background checks for. And part C is just to be clear that this statute is not being passed to be in conflict in any way with the background checks that are being performed under the state tribal gaming compacts. And the reason that this law is needed is there's a whole separate federal process for of approval that's needed before the federal government permits certain background checks to be performed. But the state has to submit its statute to the federal government to receive that approval. So this is the first step that we need to take to start that approval process.
Okay. Well, thank you. Members, I'm going to move the A150147 amendment. Is there any questions?
About the amendment or the bill?
The amendment.
We don't have copies of it?
Any questions on the amendment? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hey, Representative Green, go on with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There again, I will. We open up to questions. The bill is before you. I think that Mr. LeBeau has explained it, but it is a bill that was brought to me by the Fond du Lac tribe in particular, and I will hand it off the questions to Mr. LeBeau. Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who's paying for it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, appreciate that question. We addressed that in the bill on, I believe, line 1.12 and 1.13. The band will pay for it.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed.
Would we make that request?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. LeBeau, in your explanation of the amendment, you had mentioned that any felony disqualifies an individual for running for elected office within the tribe. Is that correct? Or
go ahead. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, I know that there's a particular category of felonies. I'm happy to follow up and let you know specifically what that is. But that's a matter of MCT law.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lowe, that'd be great if you could give me the list of the exclusions and ones that I guess wouldn't exclude an individual. Thank you.
There any other questions from the committee? Representative Newberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to the bill's author. Representative Green, just a preliminary question here, or just kind of a curiosity, I would say. Is this a two-way kind of a thing? So if we have a tribal member who's not living on the tribe, if they're running for an office that's not tribal related, would we be able to request some kind of a background check to the tribe to see if there was any issues that they had while they were with the, you know, with the tribal government that would pertain? You see what I'm saying? Does this work both ways, or is at this time, is it just kind of a one-way street?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, I don't believe this bill addresses that, but I will again hand that off to Mr. LeBeau if he has an answer for that question.
Mr. LeBeau.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't honestly tell you what level of records we keep on those offenses. We don't have Minnesota. Not to get overly technical, Minnesota is a public law 280 state, which means that the state has criminal jurisdiction within the reservation boundaries, with the exclusion of Red Lake and Boyce Fort. So those types of records wouldn't be in our possession on the whole. In certain instances, if we do have records like that, I'm not aware of anything that would preclude us from sharing that information. But
no further questions. Thank you.
Representative Hurtaz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. LeBeau. There are private repositories with regard to data collection when you want to check on somebody's background regarding housing issues and whatnot. Is there any particular reason that you're asking the BCA to be performing these rather than utilizing the agencies, the private data collection agencies that exist for the purposes that you enumerated in your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have utilized those in the past. This is just one other option, and government records, not to cast any aspersions on those private vendors, but the government records, in our opinion, are the preferable venue we'd like to go through.
Representative Hurtaz.
Thank you. Well, the bill is, I'm sorry, I read a different bill, so forget that question. Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Anyone from the public wish to testify? Any comments from the Representative Green? I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I myself have actually been one that done law enforcement issues on some of the tribal lands as a narcotics investigator. And so I understand what they also go through as well. So I want to thank you for bringing this forward. Members, all those in, I will reissue my motion to pass as amended and refer to the general register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Green. Members, we're going to have a report from the Legislative Advisory Committee on the Care of Pregnant Incarcerated Women.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Rebecca Schlafer, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota's Medical School. Almost a year ago today, I testified on behalf of House File 2833, and today I welcome the opportunity to provide you with an update on the work that has taken place over the last year to address the needs of incarcerated pregnant women and their children. So it's estimated that nearly 4,200 pregnant women are arrested every year across the state of Minnesota, and their pregnancies are often high risk and may be compromised by a number of factors that increase their likelihood of poor outcomes for both their health and their child's health. During the 2014 legislative session, Minnesota passed its first law addressing the needs of incarcerated pregnant women and postpartum women. The law created consistency in care, treatment, and education across the correctional system and was passed with unanimous support. Last year's law also outlined a legislative advisory committee that I was tasked with leading. Over the last year, stakeholders from corrections, both the Department of Corrections and the Sheriff's Association, as well as representatives from health, human services, and community organizations, convened to discuss the law and the implications of the law for subsequent criminal justice practice and policy. Our committee worked collaboratively to identify the key issues related to the care, treatment, and education of pregnant women in custody. And through this process, we have prepared a report outlining both short and long-term recommendations. The Legislative Advisory Committee's report also includes specific recommendations for changes to the legislative language, which Representative Lane will outline in just a moment. So in addition to this report, we have also worked to prepare a publication for practitioners on this topic and a corresponding policy brief, which was distributed this morning. And in addition, you'll see a letter from Paul Coughlin, the jail administrator from Carlton County, expressing his support for this bill and his perspective as a rural jail administrator. As you'll see in these materials, the issues facing incarcerated pregnant women are complex. And to be effective, our committee had to recognize the inherent differences in our only women's state prison and the county jails, both rural and urban, and the differences in the facility's structure, staffing, and resources. Ultimately, our committee worked together to identify ways that our state can balance both safety and security, while also recognizing ways to support some of our state's most vulnerable women and their children. Before I turn it over to Representative Lane to discuss these specific recommendations, I'd just like to thank her for being a champion of this issue and bringing the bill forward. I'd also like to recognize members of the committee, including the committee's chair, Representative Tony Cornish, as well as Representatives Kathy Lohmer, Ryan Winkler, and Joanne Ward. Thank you for signing on as supporters. Thank you for your time and attention.
Representative Lane.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have the bill, House File 1247, and I have a small amendment to go with it to begin with.
First of all, I'm going to...
I think it's the A2 amendment.
Let me bring the bill up before us. Go ahead with your A2 amendment.
Do we need to pass the bill onto the table first?
At this time, we're planning to lay it over for possible inclusion. In the omnibus bill.
The amendment A2, it just simply adds the words other inmates when the jails consider what situations may require the use of restraints outside of this bill. So we just add other inmates to the concern.
I will move the A2 amendment. Any questions from the committee? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Pat, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you heard from Dr. Slafer, the advisory committee suggested some fine-tuning to the bill that we passed unanimously last year to improve these outcomes for incarcerated women and their babies. So there's five items to this bill. First, we clarify that wrist restraints are applied in such a way that the pregnant woman can catch herself when she falls forward. This language reflects what's considered best practices by the National Commission on Correctional Health Care. And secondly, we provide for a reporting requirement, which is the best practice by the Bureau of Justice Administration, simply to note that when handcuffs are used behind the body, the DOC will decide exactly what is reported, and this bill only sets up a reporting requirement so we know when they're not restrained in front. Third, we are modifying when pregnancy testing would be required. It was too onerous for the county jails to test all women after they're arrested. Often there's a rapid turnover, and rural jails may not have medical staff on site every day. So we've chosen day 14 because it coincides with existing mandates on screening inmates for TB. Fourth, we're also modifying when testing for sexually transmitted infections is done. Instead of just requiring this testing, we're providing for access to the prevailing standard of care for pregnant women or the current practice of the medical care provider. And then this, the standard of care would automatically assume have testing for STIs. And fifth, we said in last year's bill that pregnant women would be advised of applicable laws and policies governing their incarceration, but we realize that those women who have given birth in the last 6 months also need this information, so we've added them. So those are the simple changes. This bill is endorsed by the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota, the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition, the ISIS Rising Prison Doula Project, the University of Minnesota Department of Pediatrics, and it has the approval of both the DOC and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. So I ask for your support.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Ward.
Just a clarification on DOC or all jails, prisons for women.
Right. We have the jails are run by the sheriffs, and we have the Minnesota Sheriff's Association on board.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is what happens are they when you have someone incarcerated and they have a choice whether to go out on parole or stay in, is there any idea as far as what the cost differentiated? Is there any when you want to let someone out because they get that on their own and have the baby outside of being incarcerated, what happens when they say, wait a minute, I don't have any health insurance if I get out, I want to stay here? Is there any situations like that, or how do we deal with those?
Representative Lane.
Thank you. I believe that the hope that the choice is made by other reasons than that, but at the same time, if a woman has low income and doesn't have insurance, she's covered under Medicaid.
Any other questions by the committee? Anyone from the public wish to testify on this bill? The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Neal, go ahead. You want to make a motion to move your bill?
I'd actually like to make a motion first to move the amendment. I have an amendment, the DE-5. I'd like to put the bill in the proper order first.
Go ahead. Why don't you explain your DE or your amendment?
So the DE-5 really is just doing some clarifying pieces. I kind of prefer to just put it all together so that we can see it as a total package, and then I can talk about the bill as a whole. It really just further clarifies some different points that were pointed out between the two hearings.
Go ahead.
I just would like to move the amendment and then have the bill in the shape I'd like it.
Any questions?
All right, folks, any questions on the DE5 amendment? All right. Excuse me while I catch up. I just had a bill in another committee, so we'll whisper up here a little bit. Okay, all in favor of the DE5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, what is the motion for where this bill is going? Because usually you start with the motion on what to do with the bill and then the DE.
Representative O'Neill, I guess it has to go to civil law, but then I think we'd probably bring it back here and hold it for possible inclusion. We'll see. Okay? Sounds good?
Mr. Chair, I move that House file, whatever it is, 742, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Okay. Representative Winkler moves that House file
742.
742 be recommended to pass and move on to civil law. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
I haven't heard the bill yet.
What?
You haven't heard the bill yet.
Oh, that's what I want. We should probably bring it up for reconsideration. Sorry, folks, that happens when they jockey around from committee room to committee room. You forget where things are going right now.
Mr. Chair?
No.
I would move to reconsider.
Representative Dean moves to reconsider House File 742. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, now we got the bill up again. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for having us here today. I've got three members from the University of Minnesota, and I have Minkasa here as well. This has been a collaborative effort to really protect those on college campuses from sexual assault, both from preventing it to happen, from happening, and if it does happen, a reporting process and process after that to protect them. I'm just going to talk briefly about the bill, and then I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers. House File 742 creates a uniform sexual assault policy for all post-secondary institutions for both students and employees of the institution. It covers incidents that occur in the buildings rented of the either owned or rented by the institution, or any activities, programs, or sponsored events by the institution, including fraternities and sororities. This is a bipartisan collaborative effort between the institution, the advocates, and students. This bill expands victim rights and protects them from the moment that they report until after the disciplinary process is over. It also offers uniform amnesty so that it prevents punishment from the institution for a victim who reports during a drug or alcohol policy violation if they report in good faith. There's a memorandum of understanding between the institution and the local primary law enforcement It details who's supposed to do investigation, communication, evidence preservation, and information sharing. And the memorandum must be updated every 2 years. It also creates an online reporting option, which is actually one thing that I'm the most excited about. I think as we're moving into this new generation that does everything on their smartphones, which everyone has one here, I think, that they can actually report straight from their smartphone if an incident happens. They can also report anonymously, so that's sort of a first step into reporting. That anonymous report does not have to be followed up by the university, but if that individual makes a formal report, then, of course, it triggers the process. There's a data collection report and reporting requirement that goes to OHE, and the incidences are defined as in the CLARI Act, and so they do align completely with the CLARI Act, so there's no conflict. In the bill, there's a long list of things that are reported to OHE as well, which we will go into in a little bit. Comprehensive training is a part of the bill, and the comprehensive training is for security officers, administrators, and anyone else that would be involved in actually responding to sexual assaults. Each new transferring student also will need to complete a short course to learn what the legal definition of sexual assault is and what consent is and how to report that sexual assault. Students are required to complete this course in the first 10 days of their class, and it'll appear on their transcript. Also, if they have a student health services center there at that university, each institution will have to have a walk-in location and have staffed and trained confidential advocates. Also, at that health center, they will now be required to do sexual assault screening as they already do for domestic violence and other things. So from there, I'd like to turn it over to some of my testifiers today, and I have Abir from the U of M, and she is from the student government.
Representative O'Neill, before you do, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, are your testifiers comfortable with being photographed? It kind of appears to me at least one of them is not. So I'd like to know that they are.
She said she's fine. And I,
Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I appreciate you saying that, and you probably are picking up the fact that some of these have not testified before a committee. They're a bit nervous. They're here very bravely, and we do have someone that is a survivor of sexual assault, and so you probably are picking that up because I know you're a very intuitive man, and so I'm sure that you're picking that up, and I appreciate your concern.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. You state your name, and go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Abir Saida. I am the Student Outreach and Engagement Director for the Minnesota Student Association, which is the University of Minnesota's undergraduate student government. I'd like to thank all of you for allowing me to testify on such an important issue that every one of us feels incredibly passionate about. I also serve on the Board of Directors for the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, some of whose members have testified on this bill as well. Joelle Stangler, our student body president, could not be here today. It is the unfortunate season of midterms, so she's asked me to provide testimony on behalf of undergraduates at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. The unfortunate fact is that rape culture goes hand in hand with campus culture. I'm sure many of you have heard the statistic, that 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted in their lifetimes. There is a strong stigma surrounding reporting, especially because the vast majority of women do know their perpetrators. Legislation like House File 742 is the first step to many, creating long-standing institutional change to a very deep cultural issue. I'd like to focus my remarks on 3 reasons why we support this piece of legislation moving forward. Number 1, we are supportive of this bill because it expands victim survivor rights enumerated by the law. This expansion will create a strong protection for victims that come forward, demonstrating our commitment to their safety and the reversal of long-standing silence. Second, we support this bill because of the opportunity to provide victim survivors with more information about resources and the adjudication process anonymously and without them having to out themselves by physically going into an office. We believe this measure will assist in providing more information to victim survivors, giving them a better understanding of the process and increasing reporting. Finally, we support this bill because of the focus on understanding the issue. The data collection component is incredibly important to us as a state to better understand the current status of sexual assault on college campuses and develop best practices between institutions, especially those in the Big Ten. Oftentimes, the data on this issue is messy and inconsistent between colleges and jurisdictions, so we appreciate Representative O'Neill, as she has done a lot to make this a consideration in the bill. We believe this data will help us continue to make smart legislative decisions in the future. Before I allow my other colleagues to speak, I'd like to thank everyone once again for attending to this important issue. If there are any questions directed at students, you can direct them at me. I'm sure many of you have daughters who are of the college age, and they will absolutely appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to this. With that, I urge you to support House File 742. I'll let Courtney share her story.
Ma'am, if you'd state your name and go ahead.
Absolutely. My name is Courtney Blake. I am a student at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to this opportunity to talk about an issue that is very important and personal to me. I also would like to thank Representative O'Neill for bringing this bill forward with such bipartisan support. I am a two-time victim survivor on the University of Minnesota campus. Within 20 days of my life as a college student, I was assaulted in my dorm room by an acquaintance. It was a Friday afternoon. I was terrified after it happened and waited over a week to report. My campus didn't have the resources to understand how trauma had affected me as a victim and as a student, and could not and did not hold my assailant accountable for his actions. Less than a year later, I was assaulted and drugged once again, and I'm still battling the Minneapolis Police Department to get the perpetrator's name to bring it to the University of Minnesota for investigation. I'm fighting for things I never thought I'd be fighting for at age 20. This bill that Representative O'Neill has brought forward could have made a difference in my life. It could have, and it will make a difference in many. If policies had been present at the time of my assaults, I may have reported online and had an understanding of what had happened and the severity of what had happened, rather than waiting a week out of fear to report to an actual office. My university and the police department could be working on my case together, that is the one at present, and qualified professionals at my university may have understood the complexities of trauma and how repeatedly detailing my assaults was harmful to my mental health. But this bill isn't about me. This bill is about the 1 in 5 girls who report being assaulted on campus and the many more who don't report. This is about the boys who are assaulted and don't report. This is about our students and the matter of their right to feel safe at the institutions where they are going to get their education. This bill is a step in the right direction. Let's protect our students. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Another testifier, state your name and go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is Patrick English. I am a junior at the University of Minnesota. I'm studying architecture. first off, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. I would also like to thank Representative O'Neill for her diligent work on this bill and the pressing issue itself. I am currently the Sexual Assault Prevention Coordinator for the Interfraternity Conference Council. That's the governing body of most of the fraternities at the University of Minnesota. And I personally have been active speaking with the It's On Us campaign representatives from there, from D.C. And yesterday, we just had our first Safe Spring Break presentations. The University of Minnesota Interfraternity Council was the first council in the country to promote this campaign. I personally created the presentation. I taught each individual chapter president how to give this presentation to their representative chapters, and the presentation that I made and what worked and what didn't work will be used next year when the It's On Us campaign more nationally gives this presentation to campuses across the country. As well with that, I have been an active part of establishing a sexual assault prevention task force. We're partnering with the Minnesota Student Association, but it's based and focused on the Greek community, and Greek members are actively involved, being trained with bystander training, education with legislature, past and present, that are influencing this culture and issues related to it, as also training for the help and support of the victim survivors. This bill will create awareness statewide for the prevalence of this issue, especially on university campuses. More communication and the data collection will help myself and those who work with me to spread the word and awareness of this issue on campus, and it will also help others at different universities do the same thing. Related more to my own studies, again, I'm studying architecture, and in my own research outside of class, I have found and have been fascinated by a few specific architecture firms that have been focusing on building residences, including fraternity houses, that are designed and laid out with sexual assault prevention in mind. They lay out rooms in a special way. They have no like long dark hallways, and they eliminate rooms that are at a higher risk for assault to occur. But I had to find these on my own. I was not taught these in class. I have never, this subject has not come up in any of my classes. And I believe with the awareness that this would create statewide, maybe that would trickle down into some of my classes and it would be a course offered or at least touched upon in some of my classes. So that's why I support this bill, and once again, I thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, I made a mistake earlier. This bill isn't going to come back here. This is going to go to civil law and then on to another committee. So anybody could answer this, but what's the history in like the last 10 years as far as reporting? Like if a young woman who's lived in another state wanted to come here to the U of M or another college or university and wanted to find out the rape, assault, robbery rate for that campus, what was it like then and how has it improved now? And does this bill have anything to help with that?
Thank you, Chair. I actually have another testifier that might be able to speak to that. I have Minkasa here today that may know some of that historical information.
Okay.
To bring her up. Does the committee have any other questions for the
anything
student?
Right now before the other testifier comes up? No, go ahead. Ma'am, before you begin, the reason I was wondering is a few years back I had one of my infamous gun bills called Guns on Campus, and we were going over the crimes and talking about students protecting themselves. We won't discuss the bill today, but at any rate, it was like pulling teeth to get out of the U of M and other colleges what their rape, assault, robbery rate was then. That was like 10 years ago, and I was wondering if that's improved now, if a young woman or man can get on some type of internet or whatever and find out what the true actual, even if it was an attempted not conviction, if they could find out what it was like, because colleges were infamous for trying to make their college look sweet and nice and not everybody's going to jump out from behind a tree and you're safe here, and quite the opposite was true in some cases. So go ahead, ma'am, with your name first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the law and policy manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And you're correct. Over the years, the desire and need to get more information from campuses has grown. There's a federal law called the Clery Act. And under that act, campuses are supposed to report about crimes that have occurred either on campus or directly next to campus. We can certainly look into recent statistics for you and provide those back to you in the committees that we go forward in. But with all of the attention that has been placed on campus sexual assault in recent years, I think campuses have also really stepped up. If they don't abide by the Clery Act, they could risk losing funding from the federal government, so it is pretty serious for them. And also we're seeing that more campuses are getting on a list where they're getting extra scrutiny. No campus wants to be on that list. So I think with all of the work that has been done on the federal and now state level, I think campuses are becoming more aware about their reporting obligations. But again, certainly we could provide more information.
Would you define what you mean by reporting, because that doesn't make me comfortable that the college has just reported. It depends on where it goes and then what access people have to it. So who do they report it to, and then how does a student access that, you know?
Well, at the federal level, it goes to the Federal Department of Education. So they keep track of those statistics, and that is public information that is accessible.
Yeah, it'd be nice if they had something. Maybe I'll look into that myself or try to find out if they have some local access they can go to. And then Representative Lucero, to that point? Okay, you can go ahead with your testimony. I don't think we have it. What's that?
Could I just address that?
Oh, go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. You know, I just wanted to point out that what this bill does is it starts with Clery, which is reporting the incidents of sexual assault on college campuses. It will go to OHE, so the Office of Higher Ed. It also will report anything referred for disciplinary proceedings, all the incidences a victim chose to report to law enforcement, the number of alleged perpetrators who were found responsible, the number of disciplinary proceedings that resulted in action greater than a warning by the university, the number of disciplinary proceedings that were closed because the accused withdrew from the institution,
or the number of disciplinary proceedings that were closed because the victim chose not to continue, and finally, the number of reports made through the online reporting system, excluding the anonymous reports. And so the reporting with this bill would be pretty extensive, and it would get to exactly what you're asking, not only how many incidences there were, as according to what Cleary says. Cleary is very, very closely tied to our state statutes. It's slightly different, but just for the sake of making it very clear for the for the institutions, we're using the Cleary definition of sexual assault. So I think that if this bill passed, it would go a long way to get that information.
I really support your bill. I'm just wondering, report, but what I'm wondering about is access to all of that and by the student. Go ahead.
So it goes to OHE, and then it will be on the OHE website. So it has to be reported. And so you can actually go and see all the different universities and what the incident reports are.
Sounds great. Okay, go ahead, ma'am.
And Mr. Chair, I would just add one more thing, and we absolutely appreciate all the work that Representative O'Neill has put into this bill to clear up the data reporting and to really make it robust. And there's another federal law, too, that called the Campus Accountability and Safety Act, which also is looking to improve data collection. So I would say as a state and with this particular bill proposal, we are right in line with all of the discussions that are going on in the country. So with that, I will just give a few comments to the committee. First of all, MnCASA does represent 60 sexual assault advocacy programs around the state. Some of those are in communities that have colleges and universities. We're very, very pleased to see the interest in campus sexual assault, and we really appreciate Representative O'Neill's commitment to this issue. We thank her for working with us and many other stakeholders to bring this bill to the shape that it's in the committee today. We're very pleased with the progress that it's made so far. I have just a couple of little suggestions, but really we're pretty much in support of where the bill is at today. I would also like to acknowledge the strength of the survivor who came to the committee today to give her story, and to also acknowledge all of the students who have come to these committees to speak out as well. We love to hear their voices on this. Before I give my suggestions, I wanted to ask the chair if it would be possible to submit to the committee just a list of guiding principles MnCASA has put together on campus sexual assault.
You can hand it to the page and they'll give me a copy. Thank you.
And really, the bill that's before you pretty much adheres to these guiding principles, so I don't really have much in conflict, but we just thought they would be helpful for the committee to see these principles. And the key themes that are in the principles are about ensuring that victims have autonomy, that they have access to advocacy and confidentiality, that there are good data practices protections, that there are consistent practices on universities, and that there is compatibility with federal law and meaningful training. One of the things we've seen over the years, and you've noticed this, Mr. Chair, is sometimes we haven't seen universities comply with existing laws that already exist and that are in place. And so we think bills like this will help to remind universities of their obligations and also further to give them more guidance about how they can help students stay safe on campus. I will say that this whole process of working with this bill has been very complex because we have to align state and federal law. And again, I think this process has gotten us very close to that. So the additional comments I'm going to make are just very brief. First of all, one of the key laws that we've had to look at in this particular bill is the interplay of the Federal Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA. And I'm no expert on FERPA, but what I can say is that does protect student rights when they're in an educational context. It's a privacy protection. And so we really appreciate how, through the discussion on this bill, that concerns about FERPA have been addressed, and I think we're really pretty close on those. The other piece I wanted to mention about data collection, and I brought up the Campus Accountability and Safety Act earlier, on line 6.8 of the bill, it does talk about proceedings that resulted in an action greater than a warning. That's part of the data collection requirements. We would like to see something that's maybe a little bit stronger that says that an institute is required to say a description of the final sanctions that it gave. We think that would be clearer and more informative. And finally, you know, either with this bill or sometime in the future, we would love to see the legislature decide whether this will be extended to visitors on campus. Currently, this bill extends to staff and employees. We think about the Penn State case, for example, and the youth that were harmed in that case were visitors to a campus rather than staff or employees. But at this point, we're definitely happy where things are starting. So I want to thank you again for your attention. I want to thank Representative O'Neill for all of her efforts. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of really basic questions. The first is, how do campuses compare in rates or incidents of sexual assault compared to other places where you've got a lot of young people gathered together? Is there a difference between that and other kinds of institutions or places or ages or the general population? And second, we've seen a lot of discussion about this nationally. Are there any practices, policies, interventions that are seen to make a significant difference?
Ms. Palmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, first of all, with campus rates, while I don't have actual statistics with me, what I can say is they are high, and that age range of youth are at particular risk for sexual assault. You have a closed community. You have perhaps alcohol use going on. We have kids coming to campus who are just sort of out on their own for the first time. A lot of factors are coming into play. But I would really say that we've also looked at sexual assault in other institutional contexts, too. The military is the perfect example, and we've had a lot of conversation about that as well. Again, a lot of those folks are younger, too. I mean, certainly all age ranges are affected, but when you break down statistics, college age into 20s seems to be a pretty high rate of sexual assault in general. We can certainly provide you more statistics on that as well. And with regard to your other question, you were looking for best practices from around the country or things like that?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Palmer, just anything that would indicate that we've stumbled on something that actually makes a meaningful difference.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, first of all, I think bystander intervention is something that's really taking hold, and you heard our previous testifiers talk about that. I think that really people need to feel empowered, that they can make a difference and that they can help each other through situations that maybe look like they're unsafe. So I think when campuses have talked more about bystander support or when students have taken that up or fraternities, that's really made a big difference. We also have seen just through more intervention, by example, our sister coalition in California, they provide technical assistance on college issues. So we provide active training. At MnCASA, we are in constant contact with our advocacy programs that are located on campuses to find out what's going on and assist them. So I think that really we've found that campuses have reached out more. We've gone to a couple of trainings in the past year for MnSKU now to talk about sexual violence. That's the first time we were invited to do so. So I think the outreach is really starting.
Chair. Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Representative Winkler, I appreciate the question. I really do. I have an 18-year-old daughter and a daughter-in-law and a son that are up at St. Cloud State. And I had a long conversation with my 18-year-old, who is still a senior in high school and up at St. Cloud State both. And she let me know that at St. Cloud State, now this is just St. Cloud State, and not saying that this is across the board, which is why we have this bill, but she did a 2.5-hour module where she had to learn all about sexual violence, sexual assault, what consent was, and it was scenarios, it was all kinds of different things. And so I know that some of our institutions in Minnesota are doing a much better job. They're doing what we need to do. They're educating, they're informing, they're, I know another university that will be doing face-to-face interactions, and they'll be doing kind of, how to say no, and, and all that kind of, well, I don't have to say how to say no, but, just how to approach the topic, let's just say. That's a better way to say it. So, I know that that is happening, but it's not happening across the board. It's not happening in every institution. So in this bill, we're asking that we talk about it. And so before they get to the 10th day of class, they have to talk about, they have to go through the module, they have to do something to educate their students about what is sexual assault, what is consent, what are the dangers, how can you protect yourself. There are a lot of different components that are already being done at some of the institutions, but just not all. Also, I would go back to the testimony of the student that said, if I had the online reporting option, I would have reported, which I think is incredibly important. Everyone's carrying around their smartphone. She could have, minutes after, literally reported, got a hold of somebody
to get her help. So I know that that's an incredibly important thing. My daughter said the same thing. She said, I have my smartphone with me all the time. I'm always on it. And to have that option is really important. Now, she may not have wanted to call 911, but she could have at least taken the next step of getting a hold of the campus. Also, on in the requirement here, there's going to have to be a walk-in location of some sort, whether it be campus security, whether it be the health services, counseling center, somewhere that staff that has an advocate there that's trained, hopefully using best practices from MNCASA, so that they, you know, actually understand what to do, and through the memorandum of understanding with the local law enforcement, they also know how to kind of engage that and take this the victim there if they need to. So there's a lot of components of this bill that really are putting best practices that we have found, you know, through MNCASA's work, that this is actually implementing those things.
And Mr. Chair, can I add?
Ms. Palmer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The one thing I would just add, too, to all of the comments that Representative O'Neill said is I think also when we have an environment where a lot of care and attention is being paid to an issue, that survivors start to feel a bit safer, too, that people are going to take them seriously and they're going to want to come forward and utilize the resources that are out there. So the more messaging that comes from legislation like this, the more opportunities I think we may get to hear from survivors. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Palmer, as I listen to the testimony, I'm struck by how much focus is on reporting sexual assault and arming especially young women with how to deal with it. And there seems to be comparatively little discussion about the problem with young men, primarily, who are doing it. And that seems to be where we've got the biggest challenge. I'm not criticizing the bill. I support the bill. But the question I have is, and this is really for you, Ms. Palmer, is there something that we are missing in is through comprehensive sex ed, or through is it just a culture that is, I think, can be very disrespectful of women? You know, the rise of the prevalence of pornography and the sexualization of, and in a really kind of objective kind of way of viewing women, you know, you can't solve that culture, and this is something where I think social conservatives have a lot of value to add to the discussion. But the question is there something that we can be doing earlier with young men, not waiting until they get to fraternities and you sort of have this band of rowdies who are together and, you know, they're young men and they you know, may be prone in groups to behave in certain ways. But I guess the question is, before they ever get to campus, is there more that we should be doing to be preventing this kind of mentality or behavior from these young men?
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, in short, yes, absolutely. I think there are many things we can do. To speak briefly to the bill, we do want to talk about prevention as part of the discourse on campus, because certainly you can't talk about intervention without talking about prevention. We feel that's part of the whole continuum. To your question about comprehensive sexual health education and other education, yes, we want students to come to school prepared. We hope that most students come to college with some knowledge, but sometimes they don't. And so we do want to see more opportunities for youth to engage in these conversations about healthy relationships, about respect, about consent. We know that kids have a pretty tough time now, particularly in middle school and their teenage years. There's a lot going on with regard to use of electronics and the internet and discussions around pornography and everything that you mentioned. I think young people have a pretty challenging time right now. And so we do want to make sure that youth who come to school are equipped with education before they get to college. And we hope that does make a difference.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make a final comment. We also seem to have a persistent mindset that young women are to be protected from the kind of prying minds and hands and whatever of men. And I can't tell you how often I hear people say something like, oh, you better look out, I've got a shotgun, or, you know, watch out, my daughter, you know, I'm going to be protecting my daughter, keeping you away for until I'm 25. And that is not just, I mean, that is pervasive. And it is not consistent with a notion of young men and young women being autonomous selves who make their own decisions for themselves and are armed with information and education. And we do have a I just think we have a broader culture that persists in portraying women as being passive and needing protection and needing to be armed against this kind of boys will be boys mentality. And I just think the whole thing is a setup for a lot of the problems that we have on campus. And not to say that this bill should try to fix that, but it's a way in which our old-fashioned mindsets, I think, serve to harm girls.
Mr. Chair.
A short comment.
I mean, I think there's a lot to talk about here about gender roles, and that's how we kind of get to the place where we talk about campus sexual assault, because so many of these issues are wrapped up in that, and I agree with you. And the one thing I think we also want to acknowledge is that young women are not the only victims. Young men are, too. And certainly they encounter this on campus as well. But thank you very much.
And Representative Lucero and Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. I just have two real quick questions. In regards to the online anonymous reporting, the first question is, does it have to be, is there a requirement that it's the victim doing the anonymous online reporting, or could a friend or a companion do that? That's the first question. Second question is, similarly in regards to the anonymous reporting, I see in the notes here there's a language that says it's a may choose to investigate if it reported anonymously. And if an institution decides to investigate, at what point, if at all, does a suspect become aware or have knowledge of who it is that reported?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So since it's anonymous, really a friend or someone could obviously report because there's not names attached. It's permissive because there may not be enough information in that report to really do anything. And so if we require an institution to investigate, and if there's not enough information there, they can't really go anywhere with it. And I would guess that immediately, to the other question, that if a perpetrator was named and the institution contacted him, he would immediately know that he had been named. But anonymous reporting is a little bit challenging because really we're not requiring the universities to follow up on it until there's enough information for them to follow up on it, if that makes sense.
Okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for bringing this bill forward. A million years ago when I was in college, I can remember spring break would come and a bus would pull up. Some company would be sponsoring a trip to Florida, and you'd pay your $100. And it was cheap back then. And everyone would pile on the bus, and then you'd go down to Florida or Texas, and it would be one big event. As you know, miniature Mardi Gras. And those are fun. They are. However, we all know the dynamics that are involved here. So my question is real simple. How does this bill apply to these type of trips where you would have an outside organization that's sponsoring, or not sponsoring, but putting together these kind of events, taking students from a school to a location where clearly there's going to be a lot of excessive recreation? How does this bill apply? Does this offer some protections for young women in these type of situations?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Neuberger. So in the bill, it's very clear that it has to be on a college campus that they own or rent, that it has to be an activity, a program, or event that the university directly sponsors. So, and the reason is because the university only has so much reach. They only have, they don't have probably the ability to go to Florida to find out if there's any incidences. Although, I think with the Clery Act, there might be a little bit different reporting requirements. But in this bill, I'm not asking the university to go to Florida to investigate if there was an incident. You know, that if there was a woman that was assaulted, she certainly still could report the university if she was a student and the perpetrator was a student. And, you know, they certainly still could. But I'm not requiring the university to go to Florida to find out if there was an incident. And the Clery Act, Carolyn could probably speak to that a little bit, but the Clery Act has even a larger reach.
But in this bill, that would be up to the victim and not really to the university. But
okay. Any more questions from the members? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the detail of all of this. It's been quite a journey, I think, and much needed. Two simple things. Your other testifier, I think, has some things to share with us about the culture. And but my simple question is that you have used an acronym a couple of times, and I can't find anything on it. It sounds like you're saying OKEY.
Representative Winiel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, it's CLERY, C-L-E-R-Y, Act. It's a federal act for reporting for sexual assault, violence, harassment, and I'm forgetting one. Dating violence. So there's different things that in the CLERY Act. It's a federal CLERY Act.
Representative Ward?
Mr. Chair, no, you've talked about a website.
Oh.
With OKEY.
Oh, sorry. So
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So that is OHE, which is the Office of Higher Ed. Yep, and I think I had said OHE, and then I said Office of Higher Ed, but if I didn't, I apologize. And can we hear then just quickly about the culture from my last testifier, and we'll...
As you get a short testimony, sure. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relating back to comments made earlier, as far as making this an issue before they come to campus and the culture that is on campus now. Right now there is nothing that I'm aware of that such as like high school students are like courses that they have to go through or anything related to that. So in my own case as a fraternity man, like we have from the time they're on campus until like formal recruitment to train these potential members of these issues and sexual assault, violence, gender identity, toxic masculinity, and all these issues. We only have this short number of time, and the bill specifically says within the first 10 days. And that's what we're working with right now. It is a very short amount of time. And I've talked with university staff and administration about, like, what if we could implement some of this in high school and make it an issue before, or make it touched on before coming to college. And that would be a greatly impactful thing, especially for the culture, because we do, like I said before, only have, if we want to do it before they are involved in university, we have a very short amount of time before we can do that. I just wanted to touch upon that as well.
Okay, thank you, sir. Nobody else on the list? Any other comments? Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Out of curiosity, Representative O'Neill, why wouldn't we do this, say, even starting at high school level? Why not include our schools, our younger, into the same area? Because I went to St. John's for a period, and there's a boarding school up there, a high school there. So that's on campus. Would they be included? I mean, those, a residential school where they live there? Would that be, it's on a college campus, that one is. But Perpich, I think there's some down in southern Minnesota too, or...
Representative O'Neill.
So, Representative or Chair Representative Schoen, I appreciate the question, and this bill is already incredibly complex and multifaceted. Just right now, it's just focused on college campuses, anything that they own or they rent. So, if an incident happens to one of their students that's enrolled, that would be the trigger. Or if that student is going on any kind of sponsored activity by that event or sponsored activity or program. Then it would be triggered, but I think what you're talking about is maybe a bill for you to do, if you'd like to,
okay,
to jump into that realm of going all the way down to the high school level. This is, this was hours and hours and hours and many, many meetings of coming together with this. So, you know, it's a subject that we need to broach, and it just probably won't fit within this bill, but if that person is enrolled in that university, then this would cover them.
Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill, thank you so much for your work on it, no doubt. I'm just talking about then, so you would take a friendly amendment to make it to any institution that's operating ninth grade and above? It would be that simple, the same bill, it's great language.
So I realize that's not the direction you want to go. I was just curious if that was part of the discussion at all, to say, because we do talk about this, the culture piece, and I really appreciate that it's any campus, mm-hmm. including our religious private schools as well, too, because there are so many, or too many, congregation halls that I've been in that women still can't even be on the church board.
Yes.
And then they operate colleges. And, I mean, it also has to come back to we're equal. And those are the, that is part of the culture discussion that we need to work on as well, too. Just saying, you know, if you're going to do these things, you can't say one thing over here, but then women have to sit in the back of church and be quiet over here. So thank you very much for your work on it. But I hope that we can get to a point where we're moving this to a younger age.
Mr. Chair, can I just address that very, very briefly?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen. So I guess I want to clarify that, you know, if this is a PSEO student like what my daughter is, because she's also enrolled at the university, it would cover her. What you're talking about on a, other than that, would have to be a different bill, just because this really kind of centers around the institutions and the institutions' reach. So that's sort of where this central focus is. And so outside of that would be, you know, individual high schools, they would have to do, it would have to be outside of that. So for this particular bill, it would be very challenging. I don't know how we would implement that, just because we'd be requiring the University of Minnesota to follow up on something that they don't have jurisdiction over. They, you know, if it's, I think it kind of goes back to maybe the visitor on campus is, as much as we would like to do that, I don't know how practically the university can have sanctions for a visitor. You know, how do you do that? You know, if two visitors come to a college campus and those two have a criminal activity, they would probably need to go to law enforcement just because there's not going to be a reach of that campus beyond that visit. So this is really focused on the university and their reach. Does that make sense?
It's not the direction I was going, but it's fine.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, maybe
short comment. We got another bill yet, but go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Very quickly, just maybe we can talk offline. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what you just said brings up another question. When you said it includes the PSEO, also included in PSEO is concurrent enrollment. So that reaches to the high school. So how does, and that's a part of PSEO, so how does this now address those concurrent enrollment students that are taking those college courses sanctioned by the university at that high school?
Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe. So what I meant by that is, so a student, if you're doing PSEO, you are enrolled in that university, and then the university would have jurisdiction over you in that sense. So like my daughter, who is 18 and a college freshman and a high school senior, she goes to the campus of St. Cloud State, and she had to go through a 2.5-hour module, a training module, about sexual violence, consent, scenarios, everything. And the boys do too, not just the girls, but the boys have to go through this too and understand their role in it as well. But that's also covered in this bill. If that university has jurisdiction over that student, then yes, they are covered by this.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that needs a little bit better clarification, because the university does have mentoring capability to that classroom and that and those students and that teacher that's providing that coursework. So I'm a little concerned that it's a little gray there, that the university is providing that the oversight of that instruction and how that reaches down to that public high school. So, you know, and it is part of the PSEO program. So I think that we need probably a little bit more clarity of how that all works and how that's going to be addressed at that high school level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, you're talking about CIS. You're talking about college in the high school where they're still on the high school grounds, not at the college grounds. Is that what you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, that you can, what we call it is concurrent enrollment. So they're concurrently enrolled in high school and concurrently enrolled in a college course. So that concurrent enrollment or CIS, whatever you label you put on it, but that's part of the post-secondary educational opportunity process. And so my concern is that student comes here or they stay in the high school where the college comes to the high school, it's still part of the same program. Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So if they're still in the building of the high school, then they would be under the jurisdiction of the high school, even though they have a college-trained teacher that will teach the college course. It is distinct in that they don't leave the high school grounds. If they left the high school grounds and went to the college campus and actually had to enroll in St. Cloud State as opposed to enroll in the high school, it's all about where they are enrolled. My daughter does this. So she has a high school class and she has college classes.
Mine
and
does.
So she, your daughter does too. So this is who has, where are they physically located? Are they physically in the high school and only in the high school, or do they go up to the college?
Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill, I guess my question is, when you extended it to the programs that are sanctioned by the university, that to me is where that gets confusing and gray. And so this is a program sanctioned by the university, and I think it would apply. So that's where I think I'm concerned.
Thank you, Chair. So we'll confer again with the university, the U of M, the MNSCU, and the privates, and have that conversation again. But they've been involved since the inception of the bill, so I will run it past them again.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to throw another loop to you dealing with the Representative Howell's issue. In my district, the community colleges are now reaching out to the high schools and partnering with them. So the campus is actually having classes in the high school. Is that going to create some problems where the high school now has to be involved because the college course and the college students are in the high school participating with the classes? Because it's actual college instructor, college students that aren't registered in the high school. They're actually adults in the college course that's being done at the high school. And we also have an issue in that same college that I'm talking about, where they're now having the high school classes in the college facility. They're because a specialty classes for high school students in the college. So are these high school students, because they're taking classes at the college, going to have to go through this program? The high school is going to have to go through that. And the high school that allows the campus to be on their grounds, are they going to have to be involved in this program as well? I like the program, but I got some concerns with just a couple issues.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Like I had said to Representative Howe, we'll go back to MNSCU and have them look at it again. That wasn't anything that they brought up in the last several months that we've been working on the bill, so I will bring it back to them again.
Okay. Public testimony. Mr. Neumeister, keep in mind this is coming to civil law.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I don't know if this is going on to another committee.
Civil law.
My concerns were about the summary data and how it's been released. But the question that might be important for this is on the reporting, when it talks about institutions, are they referring to the institution of the University of Minnesota, or are they referring to MNSCU, or whether or not there will be specifics, Mankato State, or whatever it's called now, or the University of Minnesota Duluth campus, and had all these kinds of situations. So I think, you know, as the bill goes, you want to make sure that the reporting mechanism is clear and transparent for all of us to get something out of the report so we can see where the bad actors and the bad specific institutions are. And if that's the intention, I think that's good.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anybody else from the public? If not, and there's no more questions, Representative Winkler, do you want to renew your motion to
Representative Winkler renews his motion for House File 742 to be recommended to pass as amended to and re-referred to the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee. Everybody understand that motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, we passed it twice. Thank you very much.
It was easier the first time, Chair.
Thank you much. Now, Representative O'Neill has House File 1180. And I believe we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion. And Representative O'Neill, go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1180 is a simple general fund funding bill, $500,000 in 2016, $500,000 in 2017, to go to the trial courts to expand specialty courts, which is something that I have a great passion about as well. And it's to all the counties in the state is the hope, but I'm not sure if that kind of fund will get that far, but we will see how far that can go. But I do have two testifiers here today to talk about specialty courts and what we could possibly do with an additional $1 million sent to the specialty courts.
Okay. Whoever would like to start first with your name and who you represent, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Bill Leary. I'm a Ramsey County District Court judge. And I think it's perhaps important for me to acknowledge, first of all, there's a limit to what I can really tell you about this topic. My experience is with the Ramsey County Mental Health Court. That's one of four courts in Ramsey County. I can't speak on behalf of the Minnesota Judicial Council, and I can't speak on behalf of all the counties of this state. I think the delivery of services to those people who have been convicted of a crime really depends to a great extent on the density of the population and the availability of community services. I am here, however, to tell you that there is really a dire need for funding if you otherwise believe, as I believe, that these courts are worth having and are productive and help to reduce the level of crime, the costs to our judicial system as well as our public safety system, and also as a byproduct, helping people get on with their lives in a productive way. I've been with the Ramsey County Mental Health Court since its formation and implementation in 2005. In Ramsey County, we have three other courts, DWI Court, Adult Substance Abuse Court, and also recently started a Vets Court as well. And I know that Kim Bingham, on behalf of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, will be able to speak quite effectively as to those three other courts. But all of us run on grants. We have no dedicated funding. We have no funding from the state courts. We have no funding from our counties. Again, I'm just talking about Ramsey County, the 2nd Judicial District. All of our funding comes from either the Department of Human Services, which is basically responsible for half our funding. The other half comes from two federal grants. The federal grants allowed us to expand into felonies, moving from 20 participants to a total of 40 participants. It also provides us with a probation officer as well. These grants, one of the grants, and DHS funding is due to run out in the middle of this year. Unless the DHS is willing to continue to support us, we will have to discontinue our mental health court programming. We've got one of the federal grants runs out in September 30th of this year. If that funding runs out, we'll have to drop our felony participation, reduce our numbers back to no more than 20. I want you to know that I firmly believe that our problem-solving courts, not only mental health court but the other courts, use the money that by which we're funded in a very effective way. We, within our mental health court, have kept statistics with regard to the reduction in jail time, new charges, and convictions over the last 3 years. As of the middle of this year, we'll be able to give you information with regard to the last 5 years. And we measure our success for our graduates to those people who are in a comparison group who have not participated in our program. And if I could just briefly state that our statistics, 3 years after graduation from our program, the comparison group has 71% of the comparison group has new charges. Only 30% of our graduates have new charges. In terms of new convictions, 60% of the comparison group have new convictions. 26% of our graduates have new convictions. And in terms of jail time, the comparison group, 68%, and then 25% for our group. The last thing I want to suggest is kind of where I started out from the beginning. There's a saying that you probably all have come across. If you see one problem-solving court, you've seen one problem-solving court, that there's a great variety of approaches. But there are some studies out there that talk generally about the efficacy of problem-solving courts. And I could certainly leave with the representative the most recent article, which comes out of actually Australia. And it talks about why do mental health courts work, and it's a confluence of treatment, support, and judicial supervision. So I commend that type of reading if you want to have a greater understanding in terms of the efficacy of one of our courts. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Bingham.
Go ahead. My name is Kim Bingham, and I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. I've been a prosecutor since 1979, and I have been involved in developing the juvenile drug court at one time, the adult substance abuse court in Ramsey County, the veterans court that just started this past year, and I oversee the mental health court. We also have a DWI court in Ramsey County that takes misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. They've not at this point been able to fund supervision for felonies. I'm here to support House File 1180. Some of the statistics from the National Drug Court professional research have said that nationwide 75% of the drug court graduates remain arrest-free for 2 years after leaving the program. And for every $1 invested in drug courts, taxpayers save approximately $3.36. The savings relate to dealing with underlying illness that's contributing to the illegal behavior because of their drugs, alcohol, and mental health issues. As the judge said, there's a variation of specialty courts, and my comments are going to relate just to my experience. I support specialty courts that do adequate job of screening, use best practices, and have a rigorous evaluation. These are voluntary programs that require strong commitment from the clients and enhanced accountability from the criminal justice system. The team that is in our courts involve prosecution, defense, probation, treatment, judges, case managers. We have requirements of these clients that they are to complete the best treatment available, not the least restrictive. We want the best. They need to get their GED, they need to connect with the sober community, get employment, they need to pay their bills. They have often a lot of carnage that they've left because of their prior use, and that includes child support, fines, and they need to get their driver's license. They must have the insurance that they need to connect to health care. And our veterans have an additional resource in that we connect them with mentors. Those are veterans who have been able to reintegrate back into the community in a healthy way, and they then help our court, our justice-involved veterans. Specialty court works because it focuses on outcomes. These courts need money to make sure we get the right people access to the program, there's sufficient supervision and treatment to protect public safety. An evaluation of that is essential. We need money to develop screening tools to make sure that these clients are in the right court. We need the tools to allow us to identify the appropriate high-risk, high-need clients that can respond to this type of program. Some of these clients looks scary. And we need to use a vetted evaluation so that we just don't go with our gut, because that has not always served us well. We need money to support supervision and resources to help people succeed. We spend millions of dollars incarcerating people who have broken the law, who are trying to self-medicate or feed their addiction, but we can do better than just incarcerate them. We can give them treatment, we can provide hope, and we can cause them to become a solid citizen. And these are not easy programs. There are requirements and there are phases. There is no social graduation. They change their lives or they go to prison. And I invite you to visit any one of our courts. And I urge your support of these specialty courts to save lives, save money, and protect public safety long term. Thank you.
Okay, Representative O'Neill. Oh, and then Representative Rosenthal had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill. I'm a huge supporter of these courts, and I've visited them in Hennepin County numerous occasions. And I guess my question is, in the bill, it sort of doesn't lay out how the funding is appropriated to each county. Do you have any idea how that might work? And is there a reason why we're just going for 2016 and 2017 and not going further into the future?
Thank you. I have another testifier that would like to speak to that.
I'll be very brief. Sarah Erickson with CORI, Coalition of Recovery Investment. Traditionally, how the specialty courts have been funded in the past, the money is given to the trial courts, and then they generally make decisions based on best practices about how the money gets allocated. We didn't feel it was appropriate for us to start suggesting where the money should go. We just don't have that depth of knowledge. And we're just doing this biennium, and we'll continue to advocate for this funding as we move forward.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Any public testimony? If not, any closing comments, Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. I also have toured all of the specialty courts except for one, and I need to circle back and see that one. And I've been to several district courts as well, but this is coming from my mental health background. This is just such a logical and thorough process by which a person would go through, and like you were saying, that they really deal with every aspect of their life. They need to make sure that they're paying their bills, that they have a job, that they're getting treatment. It's just, it's an all-inclusive. It's like going into a treatment modality team meeting. It's just, it's an incredible place to go. So that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm supporting it, and I really hope that we can have this as part of our budget and also going forward as well. Representative Rosenthal, thank you.
Okay. Members, with that, we'll hold the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Representative O'Neill. And then the only thing we got going is Fun Day, Gun Day. It is going to be Thursday. So we've got four bills up. None of them are as controversial as the bills we've had in the past. I don't think there's no castle doctrine. There's no permitless carry. But we'd have resumed the room for the evening on Thursday if we need to. And we don't say that to intimidate you and taking a lot of time. And we just really thought that if it does turn controversial, we'll just move into the evening. So I'll look forward to seeing you all tomorrow.
Yep.
Tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.
Looking forward to it too.